Public Radio International. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Didn't we do this yesterday? It's Bill Murray's question in his low-budget masterpiece movie, Groundhog Day, when he finds himself as a TV weatherman at WPBH in Pittsburgh in an endless loop of the same day after day, covering Punxsutawney Phil's Sight of His Shadow and forecasting grim gray winter for yet another 6 weeks. What if there were no tomorrow, he asks himself eventually. We could do whatever we want, is the answer, and the Bill Murray character could actually learn to reach out as a generous, good person, and not least find love in the arms of Andy McDowell. We're talking this Groundhog Day about what's been called the purest Buddhist movie ever made, one of the great Jewish movies, Christian movies, Hindu movies, hilariously funny movies, too. It's a sly epic of reincarnation or redemption with as many classic lines as Casablanca. Groundhog Day, the movie, is next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation about pretty much everything. This hour, it's about Groundhog Day, a modest little Bill Murray flick from 1992 that keeps rising beyond cult to classic to monumental standing among American artistic statements of the 20th century. Of course, it leaves you weak from laughing, but it's also deep and religious in its own entirely original way. Buddhists claim it. Jews claim it. Christians claim it. It's about a nasty TV weatherman suffering through a repetitive cycle of days until he finds himself taking little chances on selflessness. Like Scrooge in Dickens's Christmas Carol, he's answering what seems to be a supernatural cue to redeem himself. And he does. With the screenwriter Danny Rubin and keepers of the cult who put this on the movie pinnacle with High Noon and Citizen Kane, we're talking this hour about Groundhog Day. The way into the conversation is through our website at radioopensource.org. Paul Schindler, in Berkeley, California, we know you as a Groundhog Day fanatic, keeper of an exhaustive online shrine to the movie. But let's just start with the basics. What makes this movie so special, Paul?
I think it's the fantastic combination of pure Hollywood entertainment, an almost perfect motion picture. And I'm sorry, just a quick technical note. I'm hearing myself fed back, which makes it hard for me to make sense.
You sound good back here. Just keep talking.
Okay. I'm terribly sorry.
And if it doesn't work out this hour, we'll do it again, as Bill Murray would say.
Didn't we already say that? It's a fantastic film, and it's got a great message. You see, I've always felt, I like everyone in the world. I love that Christmas movie with Jimmy Stewart. It's a Wonderful Life. But it beats you to death with its message. And the thing I have always loved about Groundhog Day is, number one, first and foremost, funny, entertaining Hollywood film whose message is insidious. I had watched it a half dozen times before I went to my first presentation on the Buddhist nature of it. The San Francisco Zen Center held a showing. I noticed it in the newspaper in San Francisco, and I went because I said, wow, is there something more to this film? And it's just the scales fell from my eyes. And I went from being a mere appreciator of the film to being a fanatic on behalf of it, because here is a popular entertainment that to any observer who sees it even twice will notice that what gets Bill Murray, Phil Connors, the weatherman, out of that endless loop is his sudden realization that it's not about him. It's about seva, the Buddhist concept of self, and Hindu concept of selfless service. And once he begins selfless service, he goes from being unhappy to happy, and eventually he gets out of the loop. And I just love the endless speculation about aspects of the film. For example, how many times does he go through it? I've heard and seen suggestions that he goes through it 10,000 times, 100,000 times. It would take you a long time.
How many years does it take? Yeah.
Yeah, to learn to play the piano.
There's so much here, and we're going to have to do it. Yeah, the piano thing is totally deep. I have to confess, first of all, I'm new to the cult. Second, I may dissolve in tears at any moment just thinking about it. Third, there's so much we have to talk about. The music, Sonny and Cher, we've heard a moment of it. The Ray Charles piece, the Nat King Cole piece. His own piano is extraordinary. The bit parts, including Larry, the cameraman. I mean, it's all kind of genius. And then there's Bill Murray. I mean, that is a kind of total perfection of comic acting. But anyway,
I rarely agree with Gene Shalit, but he did call it Bill Murray's finest screen performance.
Well, he's had so many, but it's way, way up there. But I just want to bring us all through the experience of that first day repeating itself in Punxsutawney, PA, when Bill Murray first senses that something's amiss. Here's a bit from the movie.
Did you sleep well, Mr. Connors? Did I sleep well?
Would you like some coffee?
Yes, please. I think I'll have a double.
I hope you enjoy the festivities. There's talk of a blizzard.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Will you be checking out today, Mr. Connors?
I'd say the chance of departure is 80%. 75, 80.
That's a wonderful little bit there, Paul, if I may say, how he changes. His language changes from the beginning of the movie. It's strictly TV, you know, go to the
all
commercial.
Arrogance.
Yeah, arrogance, but he's got the lingo bingo down. Chance of departure, 75, 80%. And at the end, he's actually speaking, you know, a human language from the heart somewhere.
He drops the basso profundo anchorman position and comes out as a person. I love that clip that you picked. I want to say in particular about it that this is what I mean by a perfect movie. 92, 93, when this film came out, it was a little early for CGI and special effects. Mm-hmm. But they didn't spoil the film by throwing a bunch of technology at it. The other thing... and I could tell a long story about it, but I won't. Let me simply say that at one point they had an explanation of why he was endlessly repeating, and then they took it out. And I think taking it out was brilliant, and you can certainly ask Danny Rubin about that, the screenwriter. Taking it out was brilliant because it respects your intelligence. So many Hollywood films, you know what the next line is going to be. They spell it all out for you in gigantic 18-foot capital letters. In Groundhog Day, they say, you don't need to know why this is happening. You simply need to experience it with Bill Murray. You discover it along with him, although it doesn't take long for us at home, at least, to figure out that he's living the same day over and over again. The American Film Institute picked this as the 34th best comedy in American history. I think that's too low. I think it deserves better than that. And
it's up there. Let people figure it out and decide over the years. That we're going to be talking about this movie forever. I'd like to introduce Angela Zito, who teaches Buddhism and media at New York University. Angela Zito, let's talk about the Buddhism in this movie. Why do you embrace it?
Well, I've taught it actually as the end of an introduction to Buddhism class many, many times, over and over, you might say. And it's a great ending for a class that begins with the life of the Buddha in India and watches the spread of Buddhism and the Dharma through the world and ends with American Buddhism. And so to end with this film, the thing I always ask my students at the end is what makes this, what we see in here, an American Buddhist film rather than simply just a Buddhist film?
And the answer is?
Well, there's aspects of, you know, how Bill Murray goes about it. And one of the main ones is he's very much on his own. And Asian Buddhists and Asian Buddhism, as opposed to the American traditions, you always have a teacher. You don't go at it by yourself. You know, you don't do it through a book that you might read or something like that. And in this movie, Bill Murray's very much on his own, and I think that really resonates with the American sense that you know, we can be spiritual without being religious, and we don't ever have to join up with anything. Right.
Take apart his progress here in the movie. What's happening?
Well, what's happening from a Buddhist point of view is that he becomes by the end what Buddhists would call a bodhisattva. And you know, Buddhism,
and what is a bodhisattva?
Well, a bodhisattva is a person who reaches enlightenment, but instead of, as it were, cashing out of the endless round of daily life, you know, and constant reincarnation, which is represented in the movie as one day after another, here the same day over and over again. Mm-hmm. A bodhisattva is a person who decides not to do that, but to come back, to deliberately reincarnate again and rejoin the world in order to save others.
But he gets off the wheel somehow.
Well, he gets off the wheel, but he doesn't leave the world. You see, he's poised at the end when he walks out of the house there with sort of walking out finally with Annie McDowell at the end, the Annie McDowell character. He's poised to begin life again.
He says, let's live here.
Yes, yes. And he's really coming back.
First we'll rent, right.
Mm.
On our website, a commenter who signs in as Devanjedi says, in terms of religious metaphor, Groundhog Day is essentially Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. The enlightened path is unappealing and impossible to understand until the protagonist has experienced everything else. Once he's experienced everything else, the path is obvious.
Mm. And?
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I think that's Siddhartha's, that is the life of the Buddha, right? Siddhartha is the Buddha. And so Hermann Hesse's book is the life of the Buddha. And in a sense, we could really say that Bill Murray goes to real extremes, right, when he finds himself in this situation, right? First he's sort of delighted and he kind of wallows in it, right? And he creates a lot of mischief, right? He does a lot of bad, does a lot of terrible things. He tries to take complete advantage of the fact that he knows he's going to live to see another day. And importantly, no one around him is going to remember how badly he treats them or what he does. And so he just does that until he's sick of it. And then, of course, he becomes completely desperate, and he goes to the opposite extreme of, I don't care if I ever wake up again. And he tries to commit suicide over and over again. But that doesn't work either. And that's very much what the Buddha himself in his own life experienced, right? Because, you know, the Buddha starts out as an extremely rich young prince, completely pampered. This is the origin story of his life. He starts out, my own image of this, of course, is Keanu Reeves being painted gold, right, in the movie of the Buddha's life there. So he starts out really wealthy, and then he leaves that life, and he goes to the opposite extreme, and he becomes an ascetic.
We're going to take a short break. As you say, Bill Murray first takes this as a license. It's a life without hangovers. He stuffs his face with angel food cake, but then something happens, and music is part of it. Those piano lessons are critically interesting to me. We'll come back to all of that. We're talking about the movie, the Bill Murray masterpiece, Groundhog Day. This is Open Source.
Hi, this is Brendan. I am the open source blogger in chief. Today, Greta found in the blogosphere a lot of people talking about Groundhog Day and philosophy. One guy quotes AA with fake it till you make it. One guy says it's not AA, it's based on Jewish rabbinical lessons. And one guy got to watch it in the third grade at Temple. On Monday, we're talking to Frank Rich. If you have an opinion about Frank Rich, it's probably a strongly held opinion. Share it at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking this hour about the Bill Murray masterpiece of many, many meanings, Groundhog Day. Here's a little scene where Bill Murray is drinking with two locals in a Puxatony bowling alley and describing his predicament.
I was in the Virgin Islands once. I met a girl. We ate lobster, drank pina coladas. At sunset, we made love like sea otters. That was a pretty good day. Why couldn't I get that day over and over and over?
You know, Some guys would look at this glass and they would say, you know, that glass is half empty. Other guys would say, that glass is half full. I think you as a glass is half empty kind of guy, am I right?
What would you do if you were stuck in one place and every day was exactly the same and nothing that you did mattered?
That about sums it up for me.
Angela, there you have it. The cycle sort of Thoreau's lives of quiet desperation.
Yeah, yeah. That's a wonderful scene.
It's a gorgeous scene.
Yeah.
I wonder, Chris, I've been curious for years where the inflection point in this film is. I suppose that's also a question for Danny Rubin, but Angela, I always thought it was the throwing the cards into the hat scene. And Rita says, "Is this the way you want to spend eternity?" At the presentation at the Zen Center, where I was first introduced to the idea of this as a Buddhist movie, Reb Anderson said he thought it was the moment when Phil found he could not save the old man's life, and that forced Phil to realize it's not me, it's the universe. I'm just the vessel. I realize that's an esoteric question to pop on you, but what do you think?
I'd go more with the old man's life. You know, saving the old man's life point.
He saves it once and then he loses it again.
Yeah. He starts to understand that that although he's not, oddly enough, he's not at risk. He's at the center of something that he can't quite figure out, but everyone around him is at risk. You know? And everyone around him is going to be undergoing changes, and everyone around him is going to go on to the next day, even though he is not.
Angela Zito, what about that scene where he and Andy McDowell are spinning cards? He's trying to teach her how to spin cards into a hat.
Yeah.
And he says, "Be the hat."
Be the hat. Right. Well, that's a real Zen point.
Make me one with everything, right?
Right. Be one with everything.
But then he says it takes 6 months, repetition. Practice.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what Buddhists call their work. They call their religious life practice. It's called a practice.
So, and that's when Rita says to him, "Is this really what you want to do with eternity? Throw cards into a hat?"
Yeah.
And Angela Zito, I've got to thank you for opening up the Buddhist dimension, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Angela Zito teaches media and Buddhism at New York University. And I want to introduce Niles Goldstein, also in New York City. He's the founding rabbi of the New Shul in New York City and is the author of Spiritual Manifestos. First, I'd love to hear a Jewish reading of the Buddhist reading, Rabbi Goldstein.
That's a pretty tough opening question.
Well, go for it.
Well, you know, there is a Jewish tradition of Midrash, which is commentary upon commentary. I'm not quite sure how to offer a Jewish reading on the Buddhist reading, except to say that I think there are a lot of analogs. The one that comes to mind most readily is the parallel with the Days of Awe experience. Hmm. We have this 10-day period from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, where essentially every year, every single year, year in and year out, over and over again, Jews are essentially mandated to look inside themselves, find their flaws, work on those flaws, and really renew themselves so that they can begin the year as new beings, as kind of tabulae rasa, and to move from self-renewal toward a place where they can begin to help others and to break these repetitive patterns that are unhealthy and damaging.
Is that different from the Buddhist reading or even from a Christian reading of grace?
Well, I mean, you know, we're tossing around a lot of concepts that are very nuanced, you know, grace, reincarnation, repetition. I don't know if I want to go into grace at the moment.
Okay.
But I certainly don't want to speak as an expert on Buddhism or on Christianity, but I certainly think there are resonances of all of those things. In Judaism, for example, going back to the ritual of the Days of Awe, you know, that 10-day essentially spiritual pilgrimage that we go on every fall. In a sense, part of it is the result of our own work, our own efforts. But as you point out, part of it is connected to this notion of grace. Now, grace in Christianity and grace in Buddhism, I suspect, probably mean slightly different things than they do in my own tradition. But I certainly think that if you believe in a theistic conception of the universe, if you believe in a God, then you have to really work from the paradigm that this process of breaking what Nietzsche would call the myth of eternal return, or this Buddhist notion of an endless cycle of repetition and suffering, we have to work in tandem with the divine, or it just ain't going to happen.
Rabbi Goldstein, in Bill Murray's turn here from kind of surly selfishness into, you know, to a discovery of others, in the Jewish understanding, what is this learning process he's going through?
Well, I think what he's doing in the Jewish context is, first of all, learning that he's stuck, you know, learning that he is in this place where he is making repetitive mistakes.
Right.
I wish our own political administration would understand that they're caught in that same spider web themselves right now. And I would argue our culture as a whole is in that kind of place. But what I think Judaism would have to say is that until you reach that stage of self-awareness, when you realize you're trapped in this web of repetitive mistakes, you cannot move forward to self-improvement, self-renewal. And then in my tradition, from my academic colleague before me, you know, I agree, you have to move beyond the self toward others. And so this self-renewal, unless it leads to acting for and with other people, it really is worthless. If all we're doing is working on ourselves and not on the world as a whole, then I'm not quite sure where the merit lies.
The social and political side, I must say, is fascinating. And without getting too political about it, let's stay there for a moment. Bill Murray in the movie is on his own. He doesn't even have a teacher.
Right.
But you're raising the question, and it's a good one, what would it mean for a society, even for a country, even for ours, to be learning from its mistakes?
Well, I think it would mean, hopefully, a state of progression as opposed to a state of paralysis. And I think that relates to the individual as well as the corporate spheres. So if you don't learn from your mistakes, you will never grow as an individual and you will never grow as a community or as a nation. And I think that is why in my tradition, as well as other traditions, you have rites, rituals, and ceremonies that come back over and over and over again.
But as a society, do we have to go through depression, near suicide, really hit the bottom before we come back?
I think the answer is yes. You know, I think it was Jefferson who said, you know, every generation or every 20 years, you know, our society needs a revolution. So, you know, St. John of the Cross talks about the dark night of the soul. The Jewish mystics interpret the Hebrew word Mitzrayim, which means Egypt, as Mitzarim, which means the narrow straits. You know, all of us have to go through valleys in order to reach peaks. And I think that until we achieve the state of perfection, and I'm not quite sure when that happens, because I think as human beings who are always flawed, this is going to be an endless process. We are never going to reach that messianic era that at least the monotheistic faiths say is our summum bonum, our primary goal.
Rabbi Niles Goldstein, this is absolutely fascinating and enormously challenging, and you add, if it's possible, to the joy of that movie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Are we ready for Danny Rubin, the screenwriter? Danny Rubin?
Hello?
This is a script of a lifetime. It's a script about a lifetime. It's You can quit, and you'll end way ahead.
Yeah, I have. I do. I am.
I watched this movie thinking, this man has been saving the best lines and the best insights of many, many years to put this movie together, including that, you know, the plays around that half empty, half full thing. I love that little moment. How long did it take you to think up the breaking the pencil and then waking up to find that the pencil is unbroken?
Well, this is funny because that was a Herald idea. And thanks for bringing it up. In the original draft, he had it was just something else. He had a suitcase that a suit bag that he hung on the back of a door. And before he went to bed, he'd knock it off so that he would see if it would be back there again. So it became the pencil. The most simple thing always seemed to be the best, and that was the choice that Harold made.
Let's talk about how this movie happened. Bill Murray said that the script was a masterpiece before he saw it, and then an awful lot of things happened, like the improvisation or the amendment you just mentioned.
Well, that's the lovely thing about making movies. It is a collaborative effort, and when you get a room full of incredibly talented, creative people, if they like the project, then they're just going to add to it.
Mr. Rubin, this is Paul Schindler. I want to briefly, don't want to waste the national audience's time saying how much I like your work and respect it, but I thought there was a great story about the question of whether to explain why he's in this loop.
It was never a question in my mind. I never had an explanation. When the studio got it, they saw it as a comedy, and that would be the way to go, would be to put in an explanation. And when somebody called me up, I can't remember who, and said, "We need an explanation here. The studio needs an explanation." I was apoplectic. And I said, "What, a gypsy curse scene?" And they said, "Yeah, a gypsy curse scene. Please don't make me write a gypsy curse scene." And they said, just write it. And I spoke with Harold about it. He said, "Just write it, and we'll cut it out. Don't worry about it." And so I don't think they ever shot it.
Could we talk a little bit about, you know, the Harold Ramis piece and the Bill Murray piece? I seem to have read somewhere that Murray kept wanting to go deep with the philosophical implications, and it was Ramis who kept reminding him that, no, this is a comedy, Bill. But we also know that Ramis and Murray never spoke after this movie. What was going on there?
About what their discussion about the movie before the movie got made?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what's going on there. I mean, you'll have to ask them.
Well,
I know they were sort of, you know, Bill was being a little stubborn at the time. I don't know. There were some times that he wasn't speaking with Harold about things during pre-production, but, you know, whatever it was, they worked it out.
What did Murray wing it? I mean, where did he wing it in the production, and what did he add as a writer?
Probably a lot of little touches, for sure. I know that Harold likes to work improvisationally with his actors in comedies because it keeps things fresh. You know, after take one or take two, you really have to improvise somewhat. There's a few little touches, like when he calls the other newscaster hairdo. It just feels so Bill Murray-ish to me. I know I didn't write that. And I think the very, very sweet scene where Andy McDowell falls asleep and he's talking to her in his sleep, in her sleep. That was very much Bill. It came from a personal moment with him, and he was trying to recreate it in some way.
Let's listen to a little bit of Bill Murray, sort of, he's being the weatherman, but he's way, you know, out of character and off script here.
This is pitiful. 1,000 people freezing their butts off waiting to worship a rat. What a hype. Sound like they used to mean something in this town. They used to pull the hog out and they used to eat it. You're hypocrites, all of you. You got a problem with what I'm saying, Larry? Untie your tongue and you come out here and talk, huh? Am I upsetting you, princess? You know, you want a prediction about the weather. You're asking the wrong Phil. I'll give you a winter prediction. It's gonna be cold. It's gonna be gray, and it's gonna last you for the rest of your life.
Danny Rubin, I want you to claim all of that writing, including the princess line about Andy McDowell.
What's that?
Well, just tell us how those lines get assembled. Was it all you? Did Bill Murray, did he improvise?
That particular line, listening to it now, I think that was a good choice because I would guess that all three of us had something to do with that. I think I laid out how it should play and what it is, and several of the pieces of the lines are mine. I think Harold put in some stuff in there, and I think Bill improvised a little bit.
Danny Rubin, I wish
Mr.
you just...
Mr. Rubin, is it...
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask... Yeah.
Go for it, Paul.
I was just going to ask. I've been wondering for years, and I could have emailed you, I guess, but since I have you here, was the theme of selflessness to get out of an endless loop, were you thinking Buddhism, were you thinking Judaism when you wrote this story, or was it just entertainment and it just turned out accidentally to have a message?
Boy, a little bit of both of those things. I wasn't thinking specifically about Buddhism, although I was thinking of it as Siddhartha-like in that it was a young man's journey through life. And it was kind of a human experiment in my thinking that if you took a guy who was a jerk and a self-centered fellow, and if he lived long enough, would he ever change? And I created a kind of eternity in my mind thinking it through, and then thought that it would be too unwieldy to deal with all the time changes, the French Revolution and whatever. And so I thought, well, what if it happened on the same day? And I was aware that then you were taking an eternity and turning it into a circle of repetition, and that that was immensely interesting as well as dramatic.
Danny Rubin, I wonder, were you thinking Bill Murray? Were you thinking TV weatherman? Were you, I mean, some people... Tom Hanks almost got the part, right?
Once the idea happens, you know, okay, a guy repeats a day, I have to decide which day. And the day I looked at the calendar, I was going to start thumbing through, and the first one that came up, which was the day after I came up with the idea, was February 2nd. Oh, Groundhog Day. And I knew about the ceremony, and that immediately made me think, well, it makes sense that the character would come from outside, go to somewhere else. I didn't want him to be in a familiar environment. And then I thought, well, who would go there? And I thought a weatherman would. And so just all these ideas came together in that way.
Were you thinking weather as the subject that everybody talks about and nobody
could do anything about?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it was one of those resonances. It's like weatherman. Oh, what a great idea. Well, is it a good idea? And I started thinking about, well, what does a weatherman do? He predicts this. And
a dozen years later, it's a great, great idea and a great movie. We're talking about Groundhog Day, the Bill Murray all-time classic. Some say it'll last 100 years. It'll outlast everything. This is Open Source. We'll be back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the movie Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray, with the screenwriter Danny Rubin and the cultist, dare I say, Paul Schindler. Our Uber blog fan. Boy, Brendan Greeley, is monitoring the aficionados on the page. Brendan, what are they saying?
Well, there was a wealth of traffic on the site over the last 2 days about all the quotable lines in the film. So Seth P. writes that for 10 years, he and his college friends have been celebrating Groundhog Day every year by rattling off quotes and emailing each other. And in fact, this morning, the first email he received included the quote, "Pastry, Larry?" And Keto talks about the great lines that weave their way into what he calls the vernacular of we hogophiles. So it's a question for Danny. What line do you most often hear quoted back to you from your own movie?
Phil? Bill Connors? People come out to me, Danny?
How about Bing?
There's the A God, B God line, I think.
Where he tells Andy McDowell, I'm a god, not the god, I don't think, or something.
Something like that.
Let's hear it from you, Danny Rubin.
The line?
Yeah.
I'm supposed to quote the line? I don't remember. It's something like, I'm a god, and she says, you're a god, and he goes, a god, not the god, something like that.
Let's hear the Bill Murray version. Go for it, Bill.
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god, I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck? You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
Special today is blueberry waffles.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I want you to believe in me.
You're not a god. You can take my word for it. This is 12 years of Catholic school talking.
But it does turn out he knows absolutely everything, not only about her, but about everybody in the restaurant. Danny Rubin?
Mm-hmm.
You must be so proud of the fact that this concoction of yours has entered the language. I think it speaks that there must have been a need for another word besides déjà vu, because I've just been listening today to people using, including my eighth grade students, I teach U.S. history, and everybody knows when you say it's a kind of a Groundhog Day experience, and I thought very carefully about that, and there's nothing about the groundhog itself that makes it a repetitive experience, except that it happens every year. It's your movie that made that synonymous with endless repetition of the same day.
Well, it's very gratifying, of course. I'm delighted.
I love the moment when Ned Ryerson says, single premium life, the insurance salesman, and then he says it, he embellishes it. Where did Ned Ryerson come from?
I'm almost a little embarrassed about Ned Ryerson because he's such a two-dimensional character.
Bing.
You know, I mean, the idea that the most obnoxious person who Phil could encounter is an insurance salesman is kind of a cliche, but it just came out so over the top and funny. I just kept it, and everybody else liked it too. And then when Stephen Tobolowsky was cast in it, Harold called me up and said, "This guy is fantastic. You definitely do not want him in your face."
Can I ask you a very different sort of question, Danny, but that is simply whether this is a particularly a guy movie, would you say?
A guy movie?
Yeah, I mean, about the aspirations, the frustrations, the dreams, you know, the little moments of vision or self-improvement among American men.
I am an American man. And I was putting myself into the situation. What would I be thinking now? What would I be doing next? But I wouldn't have ever thought of it as anything but a human movie.
Well, let me give you just one tiny piece of it. And that is the dream of becoming a pianist. And he finds a teacher, and he seems overnight to become a sort of Nat King Cole, Ray Charles master at the keyboard. Not only that's my fantasy, but I've talked to a number of people over the years, and I remember John Connolly, the governor of Texas, among others. George McGovern, also from a very different piece of the political spectrum, saying, you know, when you press them, or when they're really relaxed and said what they love to do with their life, they say, you really want to know, I'd love to play the piano well. And I've decided since then that that's basically what American boys want to do. First, play baseball, be a baseball star, and if that doesn't work out, be Oscar Peterson.
They don't want to play the guitar and be Bruce Springsteen or whoever?
Or how about the whistling belly button trick? Ned Ryerson did it at the Senior Talent Show, I think.
See, everybody loves music.
But he didn't go pro.
No, he didn't. He didn't go pro. Oh, gosh, that must seem obscure.
Well, not for those who know it and love it, even recently. Could I introduce Charles Murray, who joins us from Maryland? the scholar, sometime provocateur at the American Enterprise Institute, author of The Bell Curve, among other books. Charles Murray, you put this on the top of your list, or way up there. Well, can you tell us why?
It was a funny situation. I'd written a book about human accomplishment a couple of years ago that stops in 1950. And I was identifying...
Volume one, right.
It was the great events in the arts and sciences. But people would ask me about, since 1950, what do you call the great accomplishments? And there are lots of them in the sciences. But as I thought about the arts, I said, what's going to still be a part of our everyday world 200 years from now? In the same way that you can go into any airport bookstore today and buy Jane Austen, what kinds of things will still be there? And I couldn't think of any until I said, well, Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is going to last. I mean, Groundhog Day is to me, so rich and so full and so complete, and you can see it so many times and get new stuff out of it, and it seems to be so timeless that if I had to bet about something that will still be around 200 years from now, I think, in the arts, I think I'd go with Groundhog Day.
I appreciate that, and especially the timeless comment, because... clearly, I couldn't have known that it was going to, resonate for so many people in such a deep way. But I did have a sense that it should not be pegged to the time it was written in, and was very careful not to have any topical humor or anything that would keep it from growing into a timeless thing if that were possible.
And that's why you'll be able to go back to it. Because with most movies, much more than books, if you look at a movie that's 40 or 50 years old, it's very hard to get out of your head all the ways in which the sensibility of that particular moment in history is informing it. And I don't think that's going to happen with Groundhog Day.
Well, talk about why.
Well, I want to emphasize, I just love the movie as entertainment. But you can also think of it, if you want to, as a profound moral fable. And if you want to push it a little bit further, you can say it's an Aristotelian moral fable. And I'm not saying Danny sat down and said, I think I'm going to put the Nicomachean Ethics into a movie. But that's sort of the way it works out. There are all sorts of ways in which the classic understandings of virtue and the classic understandings of what it means to live a significant human life are worked out by Bill Murray in the course of that movie. And where he ends up is as he has achieved virtue. He's practicing virtue in a very Aristotelian way. And it all happens without the slightest weight, without the slightest moralizing. Nobody ever is tapping you in the shoulder and say, pay attention to this moral lesson here.
What is the Aristotelian piece here?
I'm sorry?
What is the specifically Aristotelian piece?
Well, in the Ethics, there is a thought that Aristotle works his way around, that John Rawls later called the Aristotelian principle, which says that human beings enjoy the exercise of their realized capacities, and the more difficult and subtle the capacity, the more they enjoy it. And that's one way in which you watch this jerk who is making money doing something he is contemptuous of, whose whole life is an attempt to entertain himself, usually completely thoughtlessly about what anybody else is thinking. And he moves from that into a whole set of ways in which he defines his life by the exercise of capacities that he then develops over time. The piano playing is only one of them. The whole love story is a progression from the most crass kind of seduction at the beginning to, at the end, sort of a complete, I'm sorry to gush like this, but I feel this way about it. It's a complete expression of what it means to fully love another human being. I mean,
to become the person she wants to love rather than pretending to be the person she wants to love.
Yeah, and he also becomes lovable. He loses himself in the process of being a person as opposed to trying to project anything.
What do we want to compare it to? I mean, you're talking about, the greatest works of American art, I suppose, up there with Un Poco Loco or...
Well, I guess I'm not qualified to pull out specific works and compare it to them. But here are a couple of things that people in the audience who are saying, what is this man saying about this nice little comedy? Go back and watch it again. Because the second time you watch it, you're going to see things you didn't see the first time. Go back and watch it a third time. You'll see new stuff. And Danny, I'll tell you what really impresses me is you may have just been unconscious when you were doing all this. You just might have been in a zone. But that thing is so meticulously hangs together that as you see all these new things, you also don't see glaring inconsistencies, which is what you often see when you look at something a second time, or you don't see the fakery that you often see the second time. That movie bears rewatching, and that is the common thread with a lot of other great works. You can listen to it again or look at it again over and over.
I couldn't agree more. I was just going to say, it's also one. It sounds, there's a certain accidental series of events that made it exactly what it is, but very much as Greil Marcus wrote about The Manchurian Candidate, it's every participant, actors, writers, the musicians, all kind of rising above themselves in that moment. Brendan Greeley, our blogmeister, is back again. Brendan?
Well, most other countries don't have groundhogs, and so no other countries have Groundhog's Day. So it poses kind of a challenge to localize the movie. So we poked around the internet a little this afternoon, and we found out how the title Groundhog's Day had been translated in various places. In Sweden, it was translated as Måndag hela veckan, which means Monday all week long. That translation is courtesy of the woman who was unfortunate enough to answer the phone at the Swedish consulate this afternoon when I called. In France, it was translated as Un jour sans fin, a day without end. In Italy, it was translated as E giorno ieri, it's yesterday already. And this last one is hands down the favorite in the control room, which was in Germany, it's called Un täglich grüßt das Murmeltier, which translates to And every day the marmot says hello.
Oh, I can beat that.
Well, you can,
please. I think there's a Korean one. I might be making this up, but this is how I remember it. It's called Black Hole of Love.
So it's axiomatic within translation that every translation is an interpretation. So which of those is do you think most accurate or closest to what you had meant the film to be had you not been able to use the word groundhog?
Oh, they didn't want me to use the word groundhog. They did their market research and thought it skewed too adolescent because it had the word hog in it. I don't know. Let anybody interpret it the way they want. I think that's the way the movie works the best, don't you think?
I want to play, before we're done, just a little fragment close to the end of that movie, which is just a gorgeous little piece of writing, Danny Rubin. This for you with thanks from all of us.
It's amazing. It's beautiful. How did you do that?
I know your face so well, I could have done it with my eyes closed.
He's done a nice sculpture of Andy McDowell.
I don't know what to say.
I do. No matter what happens tomorrow or for the rest of my life, I'm happy now because I love you.
I think I'm happy too.
What do we do for an encore, Danny? You or us?
I had an idea for Groundhog Day 2, where basically they changed the title but then re-released the same movie.
Maybe every day.
Chris, can I plug my website, which I just got a spiffy new name for today?
Paul Schindler, you may.
Groundhog Day, the movie.com.
You may do it, and you can kind of... give us the prayer on the way out. I mean, what's to say? How are we going to remember this? Stanley Cavell, a major philosopher and also a serious writer and movie buff extraordinaire, says that, you know, this will still be around in 100 years. I say, like, you know, like Bud Powell's On Poco Loco, or lot of other. I mean, there are other great artifacts of this half century. I think Clifford Brown's Joy Spring will still be, will move people in 100 years. But for yourself, Paul Schindler, how do you want your kids, your grandchildren, your great grandchildren, to see this movie?
Like Mark Twain, like Robert Benchley, like Garrison Keillor, the great humorous writers of American history observe the human condition and render it in a timeless way that people will always want to come back to. And at the risk of sounding as though I'm gushing, I think that's what Groundhog Day does, the movie.
That's very humbling company. I thank you for the compliment.
I think it may be too humble, in fact. I think it's way, way up there. Charles Murray, what do you think?
I agree with everything that's been said. But you know what? You were asking earlier about the line that we like the best.
Yes.
My favorite is the very last, where they come out in the morning, and it's the new day, and he says, I want to live here, and it's sort of the culmination. Then he says, we'll rent it first. And that just brings it back to the comedy again. It brings back the irony. The movie never takes itself seriously, and yet it is ultimately serious. It's quite a balancing act.
It's extraordinary. Danny Rubin, it's extraordinary to be able to talk to an absolutely marvelous writer. I like the line, anything different is good. That's sort of, daily radio talk think. But it's all good. Danny Rubin, thank you. An endless admiration for that movie, Groundhog Day.
Well, thank you, and may I wish you all a very happy Groundhog Day.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul Schindler. Thank you, Angela Zito. Thank you, Rabbi Niles Goldstein. Thank you, Charles Murray. You can keep talking about the movies and about Groundhog Day, and you can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show was produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer, with help from Greta Pemberton and Henry Shepherd. Ray Fallon was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our Zen master. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.